What I'm concerned about right now in the U.S. with some of the gay press is that they're not engaging in sustained, really critical dialogues about September 11th, because they're looking with a very ahistorical gaze at those events and not seeing how they came out of a sequence of injustices and outrages against people in that part of the world.
How, pray tell, can you not be a poem? Explain, if you will, this not poemness, this state of un.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Indian courts consider gay sex and a trans woman's election, Lebanese lesbians face jail time for lovemaking, and the post-9/11 politics and not poetry of a black gay writer. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 31st, 2002. India's government this week told the Delhi High Court that it will oppose a lawsuit to decriminalize homosexual acts. The government must now file an affidavit detailing its position for a late November hearing. The lawsuit was filed by the NAS Foundation, an AIDS prevention group whose outreach workers had previously been arrested in police sweeps of cruising areas. India's colonial-era sodomy law provides for 10 years imprisonment and the possibility of a life sentence. The two judges sitting on the case indicated that public morals alone will not override individuals' constitutional rights in the case. But government attorneys declared that same-gender relationships are not accepted in India and that they are looked down upon even in Western countries, which have given them some legal recognition.
Another Indian court this week removed the nation's first trans woman elected to public office from her post, which is one reserved for women. Kamala John is one of India's hijras, transgenders often referred to as eunuchs, although they are a diverse group including many intact biological males and hermaphrodites. The hijras were marginalized for centuries, so there was quite a stir in 1999 when John won the mayoralty of Katni in the state of Madhya Pradesh. Many other hijras have since followed John into politics, winning local and state offices, and even forming a new national political party. But because John's own post was specifically intended for a female under an affirmative action plan, the court voided her election on the grounds that she is not a woman, but the man her official documents declare her to be. One of the candidates she defeated was among the plaintiffs in the case. It's not yet known if John will appeal. Last year, the city of Delhi barred hijras from running for offices reserved for women.
A lesbian couple in Lebanon could face prison time after police broke into one's home last week and found them having sex. The police were acting on a complaint from one woman's mother who said she'd stolen money and jewelry. Both members of the Mount Lebanon couple were charged both with theft, which could be punished with 3 years imprisonment, and with engaging in sex contradicting the laws of nature, which carries a penalty of up to 1 year in prison. Prosecutors ordered that they be held in separate cells. The women have been a couple for several years and intend to reunite on release if they're incarcerated. They reportedly expressed a desire to marry each other and have a child.
In the U.S., Ohio's state Supreme Court this week refused to recognize a lesbian couple as parents of each other's biological children, yet granted them standing to seek joint custody in a juvenile court. Cincinnati-area couple Terry Bonfield and Shelley Zakritz have been together for 14 years. In the course of that relationship, Bonfield adopted two children and bore three by artificial insemination, while Zakritz, who also had a child by artificial insemination, has been the primary caregiver. They sought legal status as parents of each other's children, both to protect the children in event of their death or separation, and, in their words, to confirm their commitment that they will both continue to raise the children regardless of what happens to their relationship. The court's 5-2 decision found it inappropriate to broaden the narrow class of persons who are statutorily defined as parents, yet affirmed the women's right to seek joint custody under a broader statute that recognizes an adult's commitment to a child and that adult's right and responsibility to continue that commitment.
Pennsylvania's state Supreme Court, however, found unanimously last week that gay and lesbian partners should be able to adopt each other's children. 2 years ago, a Superior Court judge had declared those second-parent adoptions illegal, saying state law reserved them for legally married couples. But the state's high court found nothing in Pennsylvania's Adoption Act that would preclude a same-gender couple from adopting a child who had no legal parents, and so concluded that it is therefore absurd to prohibit their adoptions merely because their children were either the biological or adopted children of one of the partners prior to the filing of the adoption petition. The court was considering two cases that had been in process for 4 years, one a lesbian couple with twins one partner bore by artificial insemination, and the other a gay male couple with two children one partner had adopted.
But the celebration of that ruling was short-lived, as this week the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court struck down Philadelphia's hard-won life partnership ordinance. After many years of strenuous lobbying, the city adopted the ordinance 4 years ago, extending spousal health benefits to registered partners of city employees and extending to all sworn partners a spousal real estate transfer tax exemption. But in a lawsuit brought by seven Philadelphia taxpayers, led by the right-wing Urban Family Council, the state court found the city had usurped the state's power to define and regulate marriage, reversing an earlier trial court decision. It's not yet known if the city will appeal to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
To many, it was ironic that the Philadelphia ruling came in the same week that New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg signed into law a bill recognizing other jurisdictions' gay and lesbian domestic partnerships, civil unions, and legal marriages. By presenting a certificate of any such legal action, same-gender couples visiting New York City can access any of the benefits of the city's own strong domestic partners ordinance.
And having first recognized New York City's gay and lesbian domestic partners as non-traditional family members in the wake of the September 11th attack, the American Red Cross has now gone on to use those same guidelines in all its programs. The American Red Cross may have become the first U.S. national relief agency to detail policies for same-gender couples' eligibility for disaster benefits when it issued a bulletin to all its chapters at the end of July.
Some significant lawsuits concerning treatment of gays in U.S. public schools were settled in August. This week, Nevada's Washoe County School District signed off on a $451,000 settlement with gay former student Derek Henkel, as well as agreeing to adopt new policies and staff training to prevent anti-gay discrimination and harassment. Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, which represented Henkel along with the law firm of O'Melveny & Myers, says it's both the largest pretrial damages payment of its kind in the U.S. and the first settlement in the nation to recognize a constitutional right of gay and lesbian students to be open about their sexual orientation and to be protected from harassment by other students. Henkel, now 21, suffered continual bullying from students at three different high schools in the Reno area and was laughed at and verbally abused by staff.
In mid-August, the Visalia, California Unified School District agreed to a settlement with gay former student George Loomis in what's believed to be the first settlement under a state law against anti-gay discrimination in schools that was passed in 2000. Along with the Gay Straight Alliance Network, Loomis also sued under federal law, and the case was handled in a federal court. Loomis will reportedly receive $130,000 for the harassment he suffered as the result of a teacher's repeated verbal abuse, and the district will adopt new policies against discrimination and harassment, and will provide prevention training to both staff and students.
Also in California this week, a non-gay high school teacher reached a settlement of more than $1 million with the San Leandro School District. Carl Debro, a veteran English teacher who serves as advisor to a Gay Straight Alliance group, was reprimanded 4 years ago for holding a classroom discussion on homophobia and racism without first getting his principal's approval. In early August, a jury found that the district and its policy on so-called controversial issues violated Debro's constitutional rights to free speech and free association, and an Alameda County judge awarded him $500,000 for emotional damages. The settlement stopped the trial from going on to consider punitive damages. Because the jury found proof of malice, the school district's insurance carrier will not pay the settlement, and funds will have to come out of the district's budget.
And finally, there's no greater icon of heterosexuality than fictional British undercover agent 007, James Bond. In fact, actor Rupert Everett complained to the German magazine TV Spielfilm that because he's openly gay, he'd not in a billion years be given the chance to play the most macho of all action heroes, even though he'd love to and would be brilliant as Bond. But a new biography of cinema's current Bond, Pierce Brosnan, quotes him as saying that at age 16, he thought he was gay. In fact, he was bullied at the time for what others described as his artistic temperament. Brosnan says that back then, he was young, frivolous, and full of abandon. A hippie with long hair down to my shoulders and a little goatee beard. Why? Because I thought I was gay. But sorry, guys. Brosnan, once named Sexiest Man Alive by People magazine, but also widowed and remarried and the father of two, goes on to say, but no, I'm not gay.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 31st, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Dean Elzinga.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Maria.
And together we're Zrazy.
And we're crazy about This Way Out,
the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
Thomas Glave is one of only a handful of black writers who has won the prestigious O. Henry Award for fiction. An assistant professor of literature and rhetoric at New York's Binghamton University and one of the founders of the Jamaican Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays, Glave has written extensively from his point of view as a black man, a gay man, a New Yorker, and a Jamaican. His debut collection of short stories, Whose Song and Other Stories, published by City Lights, has been widely acclaimed. Glave's work has long been an object of fascination for This Way Out's Brian Goebel, who had questions more political than literary to pose.
I met Glave on a sunny day in San Francisco. As an activist, writer, and teacher, I wanted to know what he thought about gay activism in America post 9/11 and how many voices of dissent have been noticeably silent. One voice that formed the basis for our discussion was Arundhati Roy, the Indian activist and novelist. Her essay, The Algebra of Infinite Justice, was widely distributed after September 11th. In the essay, Roy says America is fighting a war against a people it doesn't know because it doesn't see them on television. And she says, America is terribly ignorant of the history that led up to 9/11.
I think that Arundhati Roy is a highly essential voice right now for gay and lesbian people, for queer people everywhere, especially in this country at this moment, because she is enunciating and political analysis that we need to pay attention to in its geopolitical focus and gaze, I think, certainly, but also the ways in which she addresses U.S. injustice, hegemony, violence against all of these countries that are embroiled in the geopolitical situation that we're facing right now, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, and so on. Israel, certainly. Palestine, goodness knows, we know right now. Afghanistan, very much at the core of a lot of these battles. And she's giving an alternative view. She's talking about, she's superseding the nationalist and national rhetoric that I think we're hearing a lot of in this country right now, much of which has to do with people's emotional raw responses to what they see as the terrible outrage that has no historical precedent of September 11th. Because they're looking with a very ahistorical gaze at those events and not seeing how they came out of a sequence of injustices and outrages against people in that part of the world, what we call the Middle East. And what I'm concerned about right now in the U.S. with some of the gay press, and I spoke to some people recently about the problems with what I see in some of the gay so-called mainstream, more popular press like Out Magazine and The Advocate, is that they're not engaging in sustained, really critical dialogues about these very complicated politics and outcomes of the 11th. People are responding in those places largely emotionally to the heroics, and we get that as a narrative term, the heroics, the survival, and so on. Well, all that's true, but some of it reminds me of what we saw on CNN in the early days covering September 11th, the sort of narrative things that sprung up immediately, like America under attack, or America rising, or America's new war. Those narrative titles, those rubrics, kind of become sort of these encapsulating devices that truncate thought into very codified and simplistic formulae that people can then react to and say, oh yes, America's new war, or terror under management, or whatever. But she's exploding a lot of that stuff and saying, well, no, we need to look at the fact that the U.S. leveled sanctions against Iraq for years, which led to the genocide of children, that the U.S. caused all kinds of problems in the Sudan. We need to look at also things like the moves of some corporations now, like Monsanto, for example, toward privatizing water, an essential resource. I mean, you can't be queer without water. That's a fact, right? You can't be gay or lesbian without water. You can't live without water. And I think that these are all issues which concern all of us as gay and lesbian, queer, whatever we call ourselves, people. These are human rights issues. And I think that oftentimes we bracket ourselves into a particular way of looking at our issues as this is a gay issue or isn't a gay issue. So we'll think about don't ask, don't tell as a gay lesbian issue. But we won't think about it as a human issue that is human in the way that, say, immigration rights are human and also gay and lesbian, because there are lots of queer immigrants who are affected by immigration policies. We need more of a global, more nuanced, more discriminating perspective to really look at the fine points.
How does one rally gays and lesbians across the country to move into what they have typically seen as the issues that most affect them and what many of them perceive as basic rights, like gay marriage, gay adoption, those kinds of things, and blend them into more social issues?
Well, Brian, you know, I think that just in your question, you bring up a point. One of the problems when we talk about gays and lesbians marshalling across the country around issues or beyond issues that they think have traditionally concerned them, like, as you say, gay marriage or gay adoption. Because for a lot of us who come from different communities who are gay and lesbian, police brutality, for example, in Black communities, in Vietnamese communities, in Latino communities, right, in Native American communities, police brutality is an issue. Environmental racism is an issue. Toxic waste dumping on Native American reservations. Now, there are gay and lesbian people who are part of these populations, who live in these areas. So for us, I can think, you know, to give you a personal example, that when I walk down the street on a daily basis, I'm probably going to be thinking more about the fact that I might be shot by the police at any minute, or hauled into a squad car, or followed around in a store as a Black person, because that's what people see first, is my skin. So whether I'm seen as a faggot by them or not ultimately is really quite secondary or even tertiary. But what they see first is my skin. And similarly, if we're living in abject housing conditions, if we don't have access to medical care and good education, if we don't have health insurance, if we don't have access to safe prenatal care, to safe abortions, things like this, these are concerns that come up for a lot of us before things like gay marriage or gay adoption.
You're listening to a conversation with the author Thomas Glave on This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Brian Goble. Shortly after September 11th, Glave was inspired to write a poem, which will be published next year in the Kenyon Review.
This piece is called Interview with the Knot Poem, and it was written almost entirely in one sitting on September 21st, 2001. The piece really was a response to not only what happened in September, but to some underlying things that have long been really present in this country, maybe principally xenophobia and the ways in which xenophobia manifests itself in various bigotries. Interview with the Knot Poem. Interviewer. But how can you call yourself a knot poem? You look, from all appearances, like a poem. You crouch, shuffle, swing and sway, and arrange your lines, syllables, metaphors and similes, like a poem. Your flesh resembles that of a poem, of all poems, as do all your other parts. So how, pray tell, can you not be a poem? Explain, if you will, this not poemness, this state of un. Not poem. But then do not call me a poem, for no, I am not one. I came recently from that country, about which by now you surely will have heard, in which it was most unwise, ungood, simply un, to be a poem. Entire poems were murdered in silent fields. Stanzas, though begging for their lives, their limbs, were strung up and destroyed. Delicate lines and vulgar ones, those both insensitive to light and fond of it, and even mere epithets, cries in ignorance and mediocrity, simple daily failure, but also joy, were torched, leaving only ashes, bare ashes, in their wake. Erased unto oblivion, scratched out of paper villages, books unimaginable, books that, though outlawed, were somewhere dreamt. The smell of burning poem flesh, rancid, sooty, and profane, shrouded entire cities, coastal plains. Poem conversations were spied on by poem-despising agents, and entire towns of poems emptied, laid waste, rounded up and deported, torched, as I said, stoned. So no, do not call me a poem. I will never be a poem again. Interviewer: But still, you do look much like a poem, and sound like one. You smell... not poem. But then, you know nothing, I see, of the flags that, in that time, so swiftly, were raised. Raised within days. Yes, raised over 20 million roofs, hoisted high over 100 million TV antennas. Flags, proud flags, flaggery everywhere. Flags raised against poems and those who resembled them. Flags sprouted in airports, especially in airports, at all security points and all customs checks. Proof of citizenship so critical, fealty more so. But flags, too, in previously bland shopping malls and across yawning suburban lawns. Poems dared not walk unaccompanied to the market, nor, no, not ever, to worship in poem holy places. Poems were wrenched off planes by those too edgy to fly with them. Who knows? They could be one of them, some shouted, teeth bared, but shoulders cowering. Rocks in their dreams, if not yet in their hands. For, yes, did you not know? Poem children began ducking stones at school, and more than one poem, or anyone who looked like one, was felled by bullets. Bullets, the good old-fashioned kind that still served. Better than the national pastime, and more to the point. Bullets still good enough to bring down a dirty poem, to blow the heads off poem motherfuckers who should anyway have had the sense, long ago, to go back where they came from. Dirty poems, c***ing poems, poems that didn't speak the language, that chattered only in an outlandish gibberish, poems that stole jobs and their dreams, those elusive dreams, the dream, poems that flooded the nation, bred like rabbits, poems that fucked with life as they knew it, poems that prayed too much or too little, always with those awful accents, that savage garb, poems without flags, the flag. Bullets urged on by flags that stated, loudly, this is who I am and what I believe. And you, they asked, who are you? Interviewer: Do you actually expect us to believe? Not poem. Only that I am a not poem, not a poem. Interviewer: But you've said that flags were used to not poem. Oh, but let me tell you. They believed in their flag, its supposed nobility, its invincibility. Is not a flag, though it may blare loudly enough, its share of red. Easier to gaze upon, caress, than 1 million and counting scorched hands in a field, than 60 million legs and limbs suspended between leaves, than 200,000 eyes peering outward from crouching hoods, than deserts baked with dead poems and with fingers, knees. A flag doesn't answer back, after all. It makes no pretensions to having a right to its own life. It couldn't care less about hunger or thirst. It loves bombs, which inform the songs droned out routinely in its name. It drapes coffins at will and with grace. And most of all, yes, most important, it adores histories that never were, that were never taught, known, and will never be. Not history. Interviewer. And so the poems, not poem. In that place, the poems ran to the hills and hid. All bets are off, someone said. Only not poems will live now. That is what they said. And so we transformed ourselves. Yes, our faces and our hands. We quickly grew 6 fingers and 3 eyes. We covered our mouths with clever lines from novels penned by dilettantes. We made the stanza merely a memory while retaining allegory. We scaled the walls where freedom, once advertised, no longer stretched. We ceased worshiping in all the poem holy places. We replaced God with the flag for freedom's sake. Interviewer. And so now you, not poem. Now I am a not poem. Still fearful of bullets, uncertain of my lines, content with no plot. The plot, they were certain, beneath their flag, we all possessed. Their darkest dream, a poem, any poem, the unending line.
Thomas Glave is the author of Whose Song and Other Stories, published by City Lights. Interview with the Not Poem will be published by the Kenyon Review in 2003. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goble in San Francisco.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, and Brian Goble contributed program material. Thanks also to Paul Jaffe. Radiohead performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and through charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on WXPN Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 2BOB Turin, New South Wales, KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.